It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Derek Ramsey was an All-American and All-SEC quarterback at Kentucky, played for 9 years in the NFL, and then went on to succeed in business, athletics administration, and government service. And he's a member of the UK Athletics Hall of Fame, the Kentucky Pro Football Hall of Fame, and the Kentucky Sports Hall of Fame. He has served as Kentucky's Secretary of the Labor Cabinet, Secretary of the Education and Workforce Development Cabinet, and as Deputy Secretary of Commerce. He has also served on the UK Board of Trustees. And he tells his story in a book titled They Call Me Mr. Secretary, written with Dr. John Wong. And Derek, we've had you on as a guest before, but it's a pleasure to have you back. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Keith, for having me.
I'd like to focus a little bit more on your NFL days now, as we record just a few days before the Super Bowl, and in particular your Super Bowl experiences, and we'll get to that. But you broke into the NFL in 1978 with the Oakland Raiders, and your coach was none other than John Madden.
The John Madden.
Everybody feels like they know because we watched him on television for so many years, but you obviously had a player-coach relationship with him. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Well, interesting part about this, John and my relationship, and I told him for years my NFL career would have been different had I played for him my entire career. John was a guy that liked tight ends, but more importantly, he and I had a great relationship early on. For example, I had been on the team there for, maybe 2 weeks. We were at training camp, and I was just having a tough time emotionally because I wanted to play quarterback. I thought I could play quarterback, and I knew I could play quarterback in that system, but the decision was to play me elsewhere. And if I wanted to be a part of the team, I had to learn how to play whatever that position was. And initially, we had talked about possibly defense. Well, Keith, hell, I'd never tackled anybody in my life and wasn't going to start at that point.
Not at that level.
No, not at that level. And so it was. It was wide receiver and then into tight end. But the thing that I appreciated about John, he knew how hard I was working and I was willing to work and learn. And you know, I had learned that entire offense from a receiver tight end position. I would learn that offense in a week, you know, because coming from the quarterback position, when I was the quarterback, I knew what every guy did on every play. So it was relatively easy for me to pick this up. But I remember Coach Madden calling me in. Like I said, this is 2 weeks into training camp. And I'm thinking, oh, man. You know, he called me already. I'm going to get cut before I even get a chance to get on the field. Mm-hmm. And he said, sit down, son. So I sat down, and he says, you're going to make my team. But if you tell anybody about this conversation, I'm going to cut you that same day. I said, Coach, you do not have to worry about me telling anybody anything. And, of course, I didn't. And I was like, Coach, you know, I got another gear. I just got to learn what I'm doing. And he said, I know you're trying. I know you're trying. But, you know, I just need you to keep working. And you're going to have a career in the NFL.
And I think you said in the book that he talked to you about if you ever became a coach to mm-hmm. keep in mind that at the NFL level especially, you're managing personalities a lot more than you are devising football strategies.
That's exactly right. And, you know, when you have all these incredible players, and especially today where players are making much, much more than their coaches. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy for them, and the money is guaranteed now, so it's easy for these young players to be soured and to just not do anything. And I think the best example of that, which was embarrassing to me, was a receiver from Philadelphia. What's their top receiver, the big guy, number 11. I mean, run like the wind, but he's a big, muscular guy. They'd gotten him from Tennessee. Anyway, a few weeks ago, 3 or 4 or 5 weeks ago, he's sitting on the sideline reading a book during the game. there is no book in the world that's that important. And it was embarrassment to me, especially as I talked to older players like myself or former players. They're like, what in the heck is this guy doing? And so there are things like that that you have to manage. But if you have older players on that team, they go to that guy and say, man, what the heck are you doing? Throw that damn book in the trash and let's go play football. You know, if you want to read, read on your own time, or maybe this isn't the right team for you to be on because we don't read during the game. And so there are things like that in today's football that I necessarily don't agree with. But I think for that to happen, it all starts from the top. The message that you're sending, the message that what you will tolerate, the message that what we're trying to accomplish together is this. And that's not part of it.
Mm-hmm. And thinking about John Madden again, millions and millions of people feel like they got to know him, and then because of his work on television, and he connect with fans so well too.
Yeah.
And there was a story I think that that fans can relate to, even though it was a football story. But you made a kickoff return or a squib, a squib kick, and he practically chased you down the field
on the sideline. Yeah,
yeah. Tell me about that.
Yeah, John. For those that got to watch John, he was an emotional guy, and I had been, you know, trying to, you know, because I wasn't playing. I was backing up Dave Casper, Raymond Chester. We had another guy also, I can't remember his name now. But I was literally fourth team, so I knew I wasn't going to play. I was a special teams guy. And going into the next week, it was going to be a Thursday night game. And so I told John, I said, Coach, I said, man, people don't even realize I'm on the team. You know, I'm over here on the West Coast. At that time, the only time people would see the Raiders was on Monday Night Football. And I was telling him, I said, Coach, you got to get me in there just for one play so they can see that Derek Ramsey from Kentucky is in the game, blah, blah, blah. And he, yeah, kid, go ahead, kid. Well, anyway, this particular game, I think it was against the Chargers, and I was in the wedge, which is the second group of players on a kickoff return. And so the guy just before halftime, they had just scored, so he squib kicked the ball to me. And I picked the ball up and I ran it back to about our 25-yard line. And when I got there, I fumbled it out of bounds. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm getting ready to get up, John Madden just picked me up. He said, son, you wanted me to put you in the game, now I put you in the game, and then you're throwing a damn ball to me. I don't want the ball. I keep the ball. I want you to keep the ball yourself, son. Keep the ball yourself. I want us to go in and score. But I can't score if you're fumbling the ball out of bounds. Yeah. Great job.
So he followed it up with congratulations on a great return.
Yeah.
Well, that's the way we all saw him on television, waving his arms and making a point and talking to us in a way that we could understand and enjoy the game. And as you say, talking about managing the personalities in football, too. But now he retired after your first year, right? So then Tom Flores came in, and continuing with the coaching theme here, obviously a different personality. Who wouldn't be a different personality than John Madden? But but he was also your position coach, right?
Or
you
when I first came in? Yeah, Tom and I had a great relationship. As a matter of fact, this past weekend in 17 cities, a guy out of Las Vegas, named Ken Thompson, put together a podcast in 17 cities, and we had Coach Flores on there. He's now 89 years old.
Wow.
And you know, he's been having some health issues, and so we were just celebrating him. We wanted him to know how we felt about him and how much we all appreciated him. And so we all recorded a minute to minute and a half little piece just thanking him. Mm-hmm. You know, for what he had did and what he represented to me. Flo was very critical of me because he always talked about, one, how smart I was. And so when I did dumb things, he's like, why are you doing that? He said, I know how you think. You're a quarterback. You've already processed it out. So why are you doing this? And so I really liked that a lot. One, that he respected the fact that how smart I was. Second, that how well I knew the game. And why was I doing these things that an average player could do? And so he kept me, you know, in that regard, just pushing and understanding the game, but also making me aware of what he expected of me. And it wasn't down here, it was up here. Mm-hmm. And so that just makes you feel good as a player that a coach has respect for not only your football ability, but your acumen as well.
And it was under his leadership that the Raiders made the Super Bowl and right. won the Super Bowl in January of 1981, following mm-hmm. the 1980 season. How did that season shape up for you and for the team? How do you remember that that season developing and going to the
Super Bowl? Two things happened that year. One was we had traded Dave Casper and Raymond Chester to the Houston Oilers. And brought Kenny King in. And so then I go from third on the depth chart to second. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm getting to play. And not only to play short yardage, but I was able to, I don't know how many catches I had, but I know during that season I had some big plays for us to win. So I start to feel like I was really now becoming more part of the team, not just on the team. And he was always encouraging again. But that year, you know, in that trade that I was talking about with Ken Stabler and Casper, we in turn got Kenny King and we got Don Pastorini. Mm-hmm. And second or third game in that season, Pastorini goes down against the Chargers, and Plunkett then steps up and become our quarterback. Well, the interesting part about Plunkett, it was almost as if we grew up together. He had gotten cut and released from the 49ers in 1978, my rookie season, and Jimmy was just beat up. I mean, coming from New England, I mean, they beat the crap out of that guy. And so it took him, much like what we were talking about earlier, the young quarterbacks, it took him 2 or 3 years to learn the system, figure it out, and when he got his opportunity, he took full advantage of it. And, of course, we went on from there to win the Super Bowl.
The playoff run that time included a win at Cleveland.
Yeah, and I
was watching some highlights from that game. And
Yeah, you did. They weren't wrong. It almost
made me cold just to watch the highlights. But that was a, I mean, football players deal with this all the time, of course. But it was really cold that day, and that was a 14-12 Raiders win that Mike Davis made a late interception on to cut off Cleveland's drive. But what a dramatic win and one that you had to have on the way to this playoff time.
The next time you speak with Frank Minifield, I always tease Frank because that play became a historic play and they talked about it on the radio and to the fans. And it was Red Right 88 was the play. And we just knew that they were going to kick a field goal because they were already in position to kick a field goal. Well, instead, they try to go for a little short corner out with Ozzie Newsome, their great tight end. And Mike Davis undercut this thing, intercepted it. And the funny part about that is Mike played defensive back for a reason. I mean, he could run like the wind. But he couldn't catch a cold if you handed it to him with fans and everything all around him. But on that particular one, Mike made an awesome interception. And we, of course, went on to hold on and win. But that was, without question, the coldest game I've ever played in. One of the coldest games in NFL history. It was like 36 below. Mm-hmm. And the officials, they just kept You know, there were maybe one or two flags the entire game, but
let's just play.
Let's go. Right? Let's just play. Let's just get out of here.
Yeah. Well, you had to have that one, of course, as part of your playoff run to the Super Bowl, and now here we are in the week of the Super Bowl for this year. It'll be Super Bowl 60 this time.
Yeah.
So, and the one we're talking about was what,
15?
Yeah. So, but as it was. Already by that time, it became a huge event so quickly after the starting in the late 60s. But what do you recall about Super Bowl week as a player? You're trying to get ready for this big game, and there is, even at that time, a lot of attention on you. What's it like for a player?
Well, that was an interesting game. One, I was just so excited, one, to be there. As a young kid, you dream of being a professional football player. I did. I dreamed to and wanted to be a professional football player since I was 9 years of age. Everything I did, Keith, went into that. Mm-hmm. And so when this finally happens, after you pinch yourself, after you wake up from this deep dream, you realize that you're here. And that particular week, I think the thing that I will never forget is, okay, you're finally here. And then on Thursday, I step in a hole at practice and sprain my ankle.
Oh.
Right? And I'm like, there ain't no way under the sun. I mean, my ankle swelled up like this. I mean, there's no way, and no way was I going to miss this. So we started a whole bunch of ice packing and a whole bunch of, okay, you know, can you play? Yeah, I'm going to play. Yeah, yeah. You know, I waited for this opportunity all my life, and sprained ankle's going to hold me out. I don't think so.
Yeah, and that's the kind of injury that you sure can't hide it from anybody if your ankle's swollen to two or three times its size. I mean, sometimes a player might be tempted to just say, okay, I'm just not going to say anything, but they had to know. And this happened on a high school field, right? You were practicing on a high school field.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was just the facility that was available, I guess, to practice at that time.
Yeah, well, you come into those cities, like you said, it was the place that was available for us to practice. Also, with Al Davis there, with him, if he could have enclosed that thing, he would have.
Mm-hmm.
He just wanted to be at a place where if somebody was going to be filming, if somebody was going to be watching our practice, they were going to have to work really hard to get there.
Yeah.
And I remember having security all around watching us practice. So, but no, that was a tough one. And, you know, they injected that thing that Sunday before the game. And I just went out and did my thing.
And you played.
I did.
Yeah. And the game itself, once you get started, it's a football game, but on the other hand, it is the game. It's the biggest game, and
well,
like you say, it's a culmination of a dream,
you,
too.
Once you get into it, all that part goes out the window.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes business as usual. And Flo being Tom Flores, you know, kept telling us, you know, throughout the week, and Al made it as close to a home game as possible. For example, when we flew into New Orleans, when we got off the plane, you know, they had Raider signs everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when we got on the bus, on the side of the bus, they had Raider signs everywhere. When we were going through town on all the benches, all the billboards, it was Raider country. And you know, so it felt one like a home game because we were so well represented around the community.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout that week, you know, we had an opportunity to go out and do some work into the schools and meet some of the young kids in high school and address them. And so, of course, they were excited, and I'm sure they went and told their friends, well, the Raiders were here.
Yeah.
And so it's just a culmination of many great things. But at the end of the day, just to be able to play in that game and to know that the world is watching, not just the East Coast, West Coast, the world's watching that game.
And you ended up with a pretty decisive victory over Philadelphia.
Yeah.
That must have been the great thrill.
Yeah. You know, but the interesting part about that is we knew we were going to beat them. And the reason we knew we were going to beat them, we had played them earlier in the season in Philadelphia. They had beaten us 10-7. That particular game, Plunkett got sacked 7 times. They had this great defensive end, Claude Humphrey. Claude Humphrey had five sacks that day. I mean, it was a Pro Bowl day for him. And even in that game, with them having 7 sacks, we still, at the end of the game, had a few chances to win. And so we knew if we fixed what was going on in that first game, which was Plunkett was setting too deep. You know, you have, as a quarterback, you got a 3-step, 5-step, 7-step drop. Well, he was dropping 7, but he was also drifting to the right. Okay, well, Claude Humphrey was there to the right. Mm-hmm. And so as he drifted to him, it made Henry Lawrence's job next to impossible to block this guy. Claude was a incredible, super pro defensive end at that time. And so we fixed that. The rest is history.
Yeah, and you went on.
Although Rod Martin goes and helps us out, you know, with 3 interceptions, which is still a Super Bowl record. Mm-hmm. And so our guys, you know, these guys are always ready for the big stage. We had some incredible players that I had the opportunity to play with.
Do you recall the celebration afterward? I mean, not just there in New Orleans, but I guess back in Oakland, too. What was the celebration period like?
Well, because after that game, my celebration was sitting in my room with my foot in an ice bucket.
That's right.
Yeah, for the next 24 hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tried to go to dinner that night, but, because the thing about when they give an injection, and the trainer told me and the doctor told me, he said, I'm telling you, from the trauma, and the trauma being that you were running on this thing. And second, it was on AstroTurf.
No.
So just a constant pound. They said, you're going to be in all kind of pain. You know, so I took pain pills and consumed some alcohol, and none of that worked.
Yeah.
But you know what? I would do it all over again for that kind of outcome and or even just to be able to play on that stage and with those guys.
Yeah. Yeah, and obviously an experience that stays with you for a lifetime. And as far as the pain involved, it's going to be the last game of the season. You know that,
yeah,
so you got a little time to heal. But yeah, what a memorable experience. Well, you had a second Super Bowl, and of course things evolve in pro football. There are injuries, there are coaching changes, and all kinds of things happen between the first one with the Raiders and the second one with the Patriots a few years later. But take us a little bit through that journey to New England and then that second Super Bowl appearance.
You know, I had Al and I had a little falling out, and I knew at that time I was the best tight end on that team. And the year before that, 82, I was a first alternate to the Pro Bowl, and I was behind, you know, Kellen Winslow and then Ozzie Newsome. So I knew I was on schedule where I was supposed to be. And I wanted to have my contract torn up and renegotiated. And what he wanted to do was add additional years to the current contract. Well, I wasn't going to do that. That's just, no. You know, and I had negotiated my first contract myself, and, you know, I understood how this thing goes. These are the two top tight ends in football. They deserve to be paid more than me, but I don't need to be that far away from them because I'm the first alternate to one of these guys slipping on ice and falling down.
Right.
I'm the next
guy
in line. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not how he saw it. And so I'd had a knee injury during that preseason, and we had a policy. You couldn't lose your job to injury. And somehow or another, I managed to do that. But I knew that was all because of the dispute that he and I were having. But, you know, I understood early on about this thing. It was business. You know, it wasn't personalities, you know, until this man died. After those years of being cast, you know, out to the wilderness, we made up and had a great relationship. So I get to New England, and Ron Myers was the coach over there, and he and Coach Kersey were great friends, which was a good thing. But the guy that was responsible for bringing me to New England was a guy named Lou Erber. And on that 81 Super Bowl, Lou was the offensive coordinator for the Raiders, and he was the receiver coach for the Raiders of that 76 Super Bowl. And so I'd called Lou and told him, hey, I got to get out of here. I'm not backing up anybody anymore. I'm either a starter or I'm not playing. And he said, Al's not going to trade you. And I said, I went in and talked to Al, and I forced his trade. He'll trade me. Because what I would do is some days I wouldn't practice. I'd just sit on my helmet. During games, I wouldn't play. I'd just sit on my helmet, and sometime I'd go. I was doing just enough to keep myself from being fined and suspended. I would go to practice every day. I was on time, sat in the meetings, wasn't disruptive, I was just there. And so we worked out the trades for me to come to New England. New England was having a tough time with Mike Haynes. They couldn't sign him. So the Raiders traded me to New England for a draft pick and myself. And for the Patriots, they sent over Mike Haynes and Hasselbeck, big tight end. And so we got there, and you know, Ron was telling me how good of friends him and Fran was, so I was comfortable immediately because Fran and I still talked on a regular basis. And I called Fran and told him, you know, what Ron had said about him and how high esteem he had spoken about him. Fran told me, he said, I told Ron, damn it, you better take care of my boy.
Yeah.
And so Ron and I had a relationship much like Fran and I. I mean, we had a great, great relationship. He understood me, I understood him. I understood what he was expecting of me. And so they were going to, we went to a two tight end offense, and I went to H-back. And so that was designed where I was going to catch a bunch of balls. And, well, the next year, they fire Ron Myers, and the guy that brought me over there, and they bring in some other coaches. And for the first time in my career, I had a coach that I didn't get along with. And that's running track in high school, that's playing basketball, football, same thing in the UK. I never not gotten along with a coach, but for some reason or another, we just couldn't agree it was Tuesday.
Yeah, and this is Raymond Berry, who was a great player. And
right.
I think you who was somebody in your family was a big fan of Raymond Berry?
Oh, my dad.
Your dad, okay, yeah.
yeah.
And
but my dad was a Colts fan.
Yeah, and so here's Raymond Berry, who has at least that connection with your dad. And so you may have been excited at first, but then
I was more than excited.
Yeah.
I was more than excited, you know, because the guy that players, tight ends like myself, we all marveled, John Mackey, a big guy that could run. You know, he was the first guy that could catch a ball at the 30 and take it 70 yards. And, you know, I was one of those kind of tight ends. I've probably had four or five catches over 50 yards for a touchdown. And so I was just excited to learn from him. You know, because he was an incredible receiver of the time. And I was just so thankful I was going to get to learn from him and take my game to the next level.
Nope. happening, I guess. Huh?
But, you know, what's interesting, to his credit, years later, we had a conversation and just kind of talked it out, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And, I was the athletic director at Coppin State at the time. And, Raymond was still a big name in Baltimore, mm-hmm. still. And once I got in this job, and so one of the reporters called me and said, well, I just talked to Coach Berry. And I said, oh, man, okay, he's going to blast me. I got to feel this one coming. He said he could not be more complimentary about a player. He said, as a matter of fact, I've never had a coach talk as well about one of his former players. I was like, is that right? He goes, yeah. And I said, you mind giving me his number? I'd like to call him. And I called him because he had told me before, and I just didn't trust it. He had told me before, if I can ever do anything for you, you let me know. Mm-hmm. Go, I'm going let you know where I am so you can put a bomb over there. But anyway, I called him, and he could not have been nicer. He could not have been more complimentary. We just, coming from the Raiders organization, the way Al had that thing set up, the players were always right. And if you were having an issue with a coach, that coach got to demonstrate to Al why you're saying this guy isn't this or that. And I think it was because Al had a relationship with all the players, and he drafted or traded for most of the players. So he knew, or he thought he knew, the personalities of the people he was getting. Mm-hmm. And so coming from the Raiders to New England, it was just different. It reminded me of being in college. You know, whereas mm-hmm. with the Raiders, you were a man, you were an adult. Well, it's more like kids.
Yeah. It's amazing the difference that a coaching change, or maybe even sometimes a front office change, can make, because all of these people have solid football backgrounds. They all know the game. Maybe it gets back to the relationships you were talking about, John Madden stressing relationships.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden you go from, you feel like you're on the track to be where you want to be in your career, and then all of a sudden everything is different, and it becomes hard to go to work day to day.
Yeah. You know, but the interesting part, even with that, Keith, everything I've always done in my career, there was something I can learn from it so that I could be better at my next stop. Mm-hmm. And while, you know, I didn't get along with Coach Berry, what I often thought about is what could I have done better so that I could be a better teammate, so that I would have the relationship that I'd had before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, take the positive out of it.
Yeah. And I just, at the end of the day, you know, and it's part of maturity, I had as big a part in this as he did, if not bigger.
Well, there was team success. You made it back to the Super Bowl after the 85 season. Had to take on maybe the greatest team in the history of the NFL.
No,
I wouldn't agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people think that, but you obviously don't think that. We'll talk about that. The Chicago Bears in 85, of course, a now legendary team, and they beat the Patriots in the Super Bowl, going into that game, you apparently didn't think that you were about to face one of the great NFL teams of all time.
I knew they were good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I knew they were really good, but they had no offense. The game that they lost, if you remember, they lost to, the Miami Dolphins, and they got behind in that game, and the game was over. And, they had an incredible defense, but their offense, other than Walter right and Walter left, they really had much of nothing. And even in that game, one of the things that we, even as Patriots player, we thought that that Ditka disrespected Walter Payton in the worst way. How can a guy carry a team, a city, a state for his entire career? And at the biggest spectacle of all of our lives, not be allowed to score a touchdown. I mean, we all had distaste for Mike Ditka because of that. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't on our team.
Yeah.
But we all had so much respect and admiration for Walter. Mm-hmm.
That was pretty much universal throughout football.
Absolutely.
Wasn't it? He was just
absolutely
universally respected.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And at that time, of course, through the season, they had also stuck Refrigerator Perry back there and handed it off to him.
In that game. Yeah. Well, it was mm-hmm. more like Ditka created this guy, mm-hmm. you know, the fridge.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, that's great to create, but you got the all-time leading rusher in your backfield that's carried a more than average team for 10 or 12 years, mm-hmm. and now this is his reward to watch somebody else, you know, go in and score.
Let me ask you the difference as we're getting ready for Super Bowl again this year, recording a few days before the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
How much difference it makes to have players who have Super Bowl experience? Because mm-hmm. in your second one, of course, mm-hmm. you have a little bit better idea of what's coming. How much difference does that make?
It makes a whole lot of difference. But the equalizer in this game is both quarterbacks, neither one of them had the experience. Mm-hmm. Drake May plays like a veteran. Well, Sam Darnold is a journeyman that's been around, so he's had to scrap for everything. And so over at Minnesota last year, he finally put together a great year. And then he goes to Seattle and back that up. And so you got two different dynamics from the leadership perspective. But the thing I see on both cases is, and I hadn't, that was the first time I actually saw Seattle play last week. Mm-hmm. But they both of these guys have full command of their team. And I think with Vrabel, I've heard him say that this is May's team. And so when a coach give you the reins, I mean, it's up to you then. I mean, it's yours. That's, you know, and so you have to get your guys to follow. And evidently, you know, having Vrabel having played in all these Super Bowls, he understands what it takes, you know, and the commitment it takes and the leadership it takes from that position in particular.
That, I would think, would have to hit a note with you when you see the move by Vrabel to establish mm-hmm. May and to give him that mm-hmm. Confidence and turn the position over to him, and knowing then, again, about building relationships. This is not necessarily about football plays. It's about giving this guy the confidence to be the mm-hmm. best that he can be. That would, I would think, have to strike a note with you, having had the different relationships with coaches that you had.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had no better relationship in my career, high school, college, or professional, than the one I had with Coach Moss here. When I was quarterback at UK, you know, because I was ready to pack it in 1975, and I'm walking off the field, and this guy says, hi, my name is Perry Moss. I'm going to be your new offensive coordinator. And I had a guy like you when I coached at Minnesota named Sandy Stevenson. And, of course, I had read about Sandy. I read about all the African-American quarterbacks before me, so that I could be a fair judge of if I were as good as they were, if I were going to a place where I would actually get the opportunity to display my abilities. And he was that guy for me. And he came in, he says, I'll be in there Monday after the Tennessee game, be at my office at 6 o'clock. And from that point until spring football, I was at his office at 6 o'clock Monday to Friday, just he and I. And we'd go over the system and why he thought this would work and my abilities and what made sense. And so I'm certain these coaches are doing that with their quarterbacks. Mm. You know, and they, you know, once they're comfortable, they hand you the keys. And with Coach Moss, I did something that I'm sure they don't do today in college football. That's me calling my own plays. Or having the ability when they ship something in from the sideline, I could change it. I had veto power.
Right. There's a photo in your book of you conferring with Fran Kersey on the sidelines.
Yeah,
and you said,
yeah,
I probably changed the play before I got back to the huddle.
Yeah,
you at least,
yeah,
had the opportunity to do that.
That's right. Yeah, so, that's right. Yeah. You know, but again, that's that trust factor. You and that coach becoming one. You understand what he's thinking. He understands what you're thinking. Because in the heat of a game, you know, it's great that they can call plays from the side. But if you're in the middle of that battle, you see things a different way. You see it at a different tempo. For example, we're playing the University of Florida. It's in 76. Here in Lexington, it was hot. And I sped the game up intentionally because I knew we had gotten the ball on about the 25-yard line, but we were getting chunk plays. We would pick up a run at 12, pick up a run at 19, pick up a run at 6. And so Coach Kersey calls timeout. And so I come to the sideline, and Coach Moss is like, Rams, you got to slow this thing down. You're going to kill them big guys out there. It's hot. I said, I got it, Coach. I got it. He said, now slow it down. Just slow it down. I go, yep. Well, knowing in my mind, I'm not going to slow this thing down. And so I went back in the huddle, and I told my guys, I said, hey, guys, I know it's hot. I said, but I need you all to trust me. I said, we got these guys on the run. I said, we take this thing down. We shove it in their damn throat. And this game's over. I said, so I just need you all to trust me. I said, I won't leave anybody out here on the field. I'll carry you personally, myself, carry you off the field. I just need you to trust me on this one. We took it down there, shoved it down their throat. I think we ended up beating them by 2 or 3 touchdowns. Mm-hmm. Game over.
Yeah.
You know, but again, there's a trust, and the coaches trusted me. But more importantly, my teammates trusted me.
Yeah. Well, we've talked a little bit about the quarterbacks on these Super Bowl teams, but as the game now just a few days away, based on what you've seen, what do you think the outcome is?
Well, as a quarterback or as a player, you know, you're just replaying what you've seen of these guys. What you can take advantage of from these guys, what kind of surprises they're going to try to make that you haven't seen, in particular against May. You know, yeah, he's an incredible player, but he's only been playing 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that means he's played 34 games. Where the other guy has played 8 seasons, he's been a starter some, he's been in and out, in and out. And so for him, this is his chance now to prove all of those other people wrong. So he's got games going on in his mind.
So you're liking the veteran in this case?
Well, I think you know, I haven't seen them enough, but I know that Vrabel has been there, and so. You know, I watch things, Keith, like, for example, you watch Vrabel after the game. After each game, I mean, he is one. He's always hugging his guys. When they make big plays during the game, he's always hugging his guys. And it's not one of those things where just for TV.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's him. And after the end of each game, he runs to the tunnel and greets every one of his guys. Those guys will lay it on the line for him like nobody's business. And for one game, you just have to be good. One game. Not one season.
Right.
if you just have to be good one game, you know, that's a hard one. You know, you want to go with Darnold because of the experience, but you want to go with May because of where Vrabel's been. And I know Vrabel's not playing in this game, but he's playing in this kid's mind. You know, because when you can tell somebody what you see and what you think from experience rather than what you read, it's totally different. Mm-hmm. It's totally different. And even in that game last week against, no, not last week, 2 weeks ago against Houston, well, he had a horrible game. But at the right time, he made big plays. And so, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's you know, the job done by Vrabel has been incredible in that no one really expected New England to be Super Bowl bound this soon after the whole end of the Belichick Brady era, did they?
The only thing about that is that first they had the easiest schedule in football. That helped. Whereas next year they're gonna have the first or second toughest schedule. And so it allowed him to mentor this kid throughout this year. And again, when you have somebody that's seen it, you know, when I became a starter, Raymond Chester was my backup. Well, this guy was one of the best tight ends in football. And I remember this one game, Keith, we still laugh about it today. We were playing the Houston Oilers, and he was telling me about this linebacker, and I can't remember his name. His son played at U of L, and he said, Rams, he said, watch this guy's form, you know, because I'm getting off, I'm blocking him, I'm just handling this guy, and I'm thinking, what's he talking about? I'm handling this guy. Man, this guy hit me with that forearm. It got under my helmet. I thought he had broke my nose.
Yeah.
I went down on one knee. You know, I was just kind of reaching because I was, you know, had a little light concussion there. I was dazed. But again, he had told me. He said, watch the guy. Watch him. You know, so it's that those kinds of things that a guy can tell you to prevent you from going down to your knees like I did.
Yeah, just to provide the insights maybe that that somebody else couldn't. Well, I appreciate your insights on NFL life and Super Bowl appearances and the challenges that are being faced by Seattle and New England as they get ready for this one in just a few days. Again, we're recording on Wednesday before Super Bowl Sunday. And just as a way of wrapping up, of course, the University of Kentucky is entering a new football era at this time with a new coach, Will Stein. It seems to have brought a lot of energy to the position. What are your initial impressions of what he's done so far?
Well, I've met Coach Stein. Haven't really had much time to talk with him, and we're going to do that. But my first impression at his first press conference when they brought him here, he reminded me of a young guy named Francis Kersey.
Yes.
He reminded me of Fran because he has that kind of energy. Fran at the time was the youngest coach in Division I football. I think he was 36 years old. Coach Stein, I think, is 38, or I got them vice versa.
It's in that range, yes. Okay. Very close. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, but he has that same kind of energy, that same kind of vibrancy, and same kind of excitement. And I'm really excited about the jobs he's done at the University of Oregon with those quarterbacks. He's done a heck of a job with them. And so if we can do that and secure our offensive line, because if you don't have an offensive line as a quarterback, you spend most of your time getting up than you do throwing down.
Well, Derek, you've shared a lot of the insights that we've talked about today in your book. It's called They Call Me Mr. Secretary, co-written with John Wong. And you really talked about a lot of personal issues and NFL issues and things you went through at UK. Let me just ask you about writing the book. What made you think this is the right time? I need to tell this story, and here's the right opportunity.
What went into it? I had been thinking about this for some time, but it had to be purposeful. I didn't want to just fill up some pages. I wanted to be able to, when I put this on pages, that people could learn from it. People could, so often, in particular young people, they think that you came from this privileged background. That's how you got there. You know people. The football part, it is self-explanatory. You don't play, you don't perform, you don't get to move up. But when you get into the political world, I was mentored by one of the best, and that being A.B. Happy Chandler. Mm-hmm. I've had this love affair for politics since I was 19, 20 years old. So it was just a matter of timing. It was just a matter of who. It was just a matter of, you know, whether I was going to be a Democrat, whether I was going to be a Republican, because early in life I was a Democrat. And back in the 80s, late 80s, I got a chance to meet then Governor Reagan, and Jack Kemp was a big influence to me. Jack and Gene Upshaw were big friends. And Jack in particular, he would always tell me, Derek, there's room for everybody under this tent. You know, because growing up, in particular in the South, most African Americans were Democrat. Both my parents were Democrats, my siblings were, and I kind of broke off and did my own thing. And I remember my mom said, boy, what the hell are you doing? What are you doing? Well, it was just time for me to go my own way, you know, despite the influence that Governor Chandler had on me. I just learned from what he had given me, the ideas he had given me. But that started with my role as quarterback at the University of Kentucky. You know, if I want to stay Democrat, if I want to stay the way that my parents were, then that means I should have went to HBC. You know, but instead I came to the University of Kentucky, and once I left Florida to go to New Jersey, you know, that all changed anyway then. Had I stayed in Florida, I'm certain I would have gone to Grambling. Coach Robinson had came down to visit me when I was a sophomore in high school after we won the state championship. And without question, that's I was there. There was another guy, legendary coach at Florida A&M, Jake Gaither was his name. Mm-hmm. But Jake had retired by the time I would have been coming out of high school. And so it was clear I was going to Grambling. And once Coach Rob came down there and told me he could imagine me being a great quarterback at Grambling, that's all I needed to hear.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, it was like the Messiah had spoken.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Eddie Robinson won, what, over 300 games in his career?
Yeah, way over 300, I think. Yeah.
Well, you've had quite the story to tell. I'm glad you put it in the form of a book, and it talks about your, of course, your football days, and then on to business and government service as well. And you've had a long-running career now. And what keeps you busy these days?
Oh, man. I still keep my finger on the pulse in government. I will always be active in that regard. Not running for anything. If I did, my wife would leave me. So, and I really enjoy being married to her. So we're gonna. But I'll keep my pulse on that. I think it's important that the public stay engaged with our politicians, because one of the things I saw that was disturbing to me while I was there was that a lot of these elected officials, they come into the state in Frankfort, and they initially represent their constituents. Well, years later, they're representing themselves. And that part always annoyed me. And so someone has to keep their finger on them and point out to them, either in conversation or sometimes you may have to do it publicly to rein them in. Because I'm sure, Keith, everybody knows now with the way things are in Washington and around the country, the politicians today are just running free. And we as a country, I think, need to do a better job of demanding more and better from our politicians. We sent them there. They didn't go on their own. They didn't just pick up and say, well, you know what, guys, I'm leaving Kentucky. I'm going over here to Washington to do my thing. And so it's a gigantic issue. And so, you know, for the rest of my life, University of Kentucky and the state of Kentucky is what I'm going to do to keep myself busy until they start running me out of here.
Well, we appreciate you taking some time out of your busy pace to talk with us today and appreciate the observations on football and other parts of your life as well. Derek Ramsey, thanks very much.
No, thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to the WUKY Sports Page with your host, Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced at the WUKY studios by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to the Sports Page through iTunes, Google Play, or at our website, wuky.org. We'll be right back.